A Breakfast Huddle with Elliot Danker, Yasmin Yonkers, and Ryan Hwan. Replay from Money FM 89.3.
It's time to gaze into the crystal ball and look into the future, so to speak.
So let's ask around the room, okay, what 2019 will hold. Ryan, besides the fact that your daughter will be a year older, what will happen in 2019?
So my daughter is 19 months right now. I'm expecting her to say a couple more interesting words in 2019.
Has she finally said daddy?
Not yet.
Oh, so could daddy be an interesting word for her in 2019?
I hope so.
Okay, and then when it comes to the Ballon d'Or, I'm just going to ask our guest, Temo Beg, here, whether he thought Luka Modric would have been the winner, because I saw a bit of
he
a fist pump
up
there,
yeah. Good morning. Yes, of course. What a year for this guy. I could say that before the year, other than La Liga fans, people didn't really know who Luka Modric was very well.
Well, he was a Tottenham striker at some point. Yeah,
and the team that he has played in are full of stars who are prima donnas and get a lot of headlines. But Modric has been a hard worker.
Yeah.
Pieces of genius here and there. Yeah. It all came together very well this year. So
absolutely.
I was so pleased to see him succeed so well.
Nice, right? Small little guy, very dwarfish, but somehow small doesn't mean not powerful.
Well, he is the heart and soul of Real Madrid and Croatia.
Midfielder, isn't he?
He is a midfielder.
That's
playmaker.
Right. Yep. Okay, wonderful. Okay, we are looking into the next year. Elliot, next year for you? What's going to happen?
Hopefully a better year of football for me. I want to kill myself this year.
Yeah, as a Manchester United fan.
We're having coffee after this. Right?
Well, we have one of the best guys in the business to help us look into the crystal ball for 2019 to see what the global economy might be like. And you've just heard him, Temo Beg, Chief Economist and Managing Director of DBS Group Research. He heads economics as well as all fixed income and currency research at DBS Bank. Timo, you and your team released an outlook report yesterday. We have so many numbers and predictions to get through.
Indeed.
Well, you've chosen to wait till the G20 summit wrapped up over the weekend before launching it. Was this a deliberate thing?
Let's say it was a fortuitous coincidence.
Okay, so not quite deliberate. It just happened to be.
Indeed, but I'm glad it did.
All right, then let's look back at 2018. We're in December after all. How did it fare for you in terms of your forecasts? Any big surprises, perhaps?
Elliot, I have to say the world economy held up pretty well. We had so much noise this year, and despite that, whether you look at China or the US or EU, any of those economies didn't exactly do much worse than what we'd expected. Beginning of the year to 2018, U.S. was supposed to be the star of the world economy. It was.
Yeah.
Beginning of the year, we thought China was going to slow progressively, but in an orderly manner. That's exactly what happened. We thought that Europe was sort of coming out of its shell and doing a little better this year. And that's more or less what happened. So, yeah, I don't think the world economy posed any surprises. Surprises were on the noise side and the news side.
And noise tends to overshadow the actual numbers. And the numbers don't lie. So everyone thinks, oh, we're in a bad shape. But actually, if you look at the numbers, everything's on track in that sense.
You know, both from a short and long-term perspective, the numbers are on track. In the short term, as you correctly said, that the world economy has done pretty well this year, given all the noise. But even the longer term, you know, the big narrative in the West is that, you know, inequality is picking up, rise of populism. But if you look at the arc of the last 20, 30 years, worldwide inequality is improving.
Yeah.
Income is going up. It's only from a very narrow Western-centric perspective things look bad. I think from Asia's perspective, we have done pretty well in the last couple of decades.
Should take a moment to celebrate right here, right? So going into 2018 then, Temur, you had a lot of positivity. Your report was then called Strong Tailwind. Now it is called Fading Momentum. I love these names. What are the signs pointing to this slowdown besides inequality and such?
In a way, the sugar rush of 2018, it was inevitable that it would fade. You had one of the largest tax cuts in history that propelled the U.S. economy from a fairly good trajectory to an extraordinary trajectory. An economy that mature should not be growing at 3.5%, 4% without creating inflation or major labor market dislocation. But in fact, the U.S. has pulled it off this year. We will get close to 3% growth in the U.S. in the largest economic bloc in the world. That cannot sustain. So that actually sets the stage for that slowing momentum for 2019
for
and
all the
further.
Fading.
Exactly. The tax cut sugar rush will go away. With the Democrats now taking over the House, to get another legislative effort to pump prime the economy further, very unlikely. And as rates go up, the interest rate sensitive part of the economy, of course, will slow. That's economics 101. If it doesn't, it will be strange. So those are the markers for the slowdown that's coming.
What about sugar rush aftertaste? in terms of your view on the trade truce that'll start January 1st at the G20 summit or on the sidelines of the G20 summit, you think that might have helped to lift your outlook slightly, perhaps?
Yeah. It's only been 48 hours and already some bitter aftertaste is creeping in. If you see this morning's papers, you know, there is no clarity on how much tariff the Chinese will reduce, sure. Although that Trump tweet was about tariff reduction.
Yeah.
It's not clear how within the span of less than 3 months we can sort out issues like intellectual property protection and cybersecurity. These are massive issues. These are generational shifts, if you will, mm-hmm. in U.S.-China relationship. These will not get resolved in 3 months. So the sugar rush, even from this news, it's going to be pretty temporary in my view.
Okay, bitter aftertaste with a touch of blandness thrown in. Yep.
This morning we are speaking with Tamer Beg. He is the Chief Economist and Managing Director, DBS Group Research. And we're doing a bit of 2019 economic outlook.
Okay. Well, looking ahead, what is your best case scenario and your worst case scenario, Tamer? It looks like you're forecasting for global growth to be on course for a tad above 3.5% this year.
So I think unlike last year when the balance of risk was clearly tilted to the upside, that things could be more likely to be positive than negative, I think unfortunately the balance of risk has shifted for 2019.
Okay.
So we need very judicious policy calibration, whether it is from the Federal Reserve in the US or the PBOC in China or from the rest of the world. If there are policy mistakes, things can be significantly worse.
Okay.
If policy is in the right direction, it will orchestrate a gradual slowdown.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would have to be an exceptional bull to say that 2019 has odds-on probability of being better than 2018. Very unlikely in my view.
Okay. Tamer, what are the key risks that we need to watch out for going into 2019? And out of all of that, how much does President Trump feature in them?
Well, I'll put Trump a little later.
Okay.
But Elliot, in terms of what can go wrong, I just updated what we call our now casting framework for China, where we take a given quarter's available data, mix it up with whatever remaining data that is not available with forecast, and get a sense of where China stands right now.
Okay.
So today, in the first week of December, we already have all the data from October and November to give us a good sense of how the fourth quarter will look for China. Not looking very good.
Yeah.
Significantly below 6.5%, and our forecasting framework extends to one quarter further to Q1, below 6%. So we need, in the case of China, significant policy accommodation to make sure that such weak trajectory do not become even further and in the wrong direction.
All right.
So that's issue number one, that independent of trade wars, independent of Donald Trump's rhetoric, China has this internal recalibration going on, deleveraging, moving away from investment to consumption. These are painful adjustments. In any case, trade noise makes it worse. Mm-hmm. So that's issue one. Second is the issue of the U.S. President Trump has potential pipeline legal troubles that could get in the way of policy efficacy. How the relationship between the House and the Senate and the president works out, I think odds on it'll be fairly dysfunctional. And therefore, we will probably not get too much oomph from the policy side in the U.S. either. And then, of course, there are the perennial noise out of Europe, whether it is Brexit or Italy and so on. So I think as soon as we start 2019, we'll start talking about Iran sanction issue, expiration of this truce between the U.S. and China, further risks around Brexit, further risks around Italy. So it will not be a very happy beginning to 2019, and that could set the tone for the rest of the year.
Right. It's a lot of the fallback of everything that's happened in 2018 as well.
That's right.
You know, I'd like Ryan to join in on this chat, because Ryan, you're keeping your eye on China's third quarter GDP numbers, 6.5%, and you had something to ask Tamer about that.
Hey, Tamer, so you mentioned your NARCAS. You're looking at China slowing down to potentially 6%. That is going to be quite a number, quite a low point for China. More than 10 years, we haven't seen that type of number for China yet.
Absolutely, Ryan. See, 6% on its own seems like a very big number. It's the second largest economy in the world, and it's creating economies the size of Germany if it grows at 6%. But the point is not what China's growth rate is. It is what it is relative to the past. So in economics or statistics, we use this Z-score, right? How far away are you from your long-term mean? China is right now more than one standard deviation below its 10, 15-year average, and it is slowing further. So it doesn't have to be negative growth to feel like a recession. In the case of China, when sales do not grow by 15-20%, it feels like a recession because their standards are so high and their track record is so strong. So you're right. 6% would seem significantly weak compared to China's stellar track record of the last couple of decades.
Elliot, you asked Taymor just now about the risks that we need to look out for in 2019. And then you had a part of your question that said, does Donald Trump feature in that? And Taymor, you said you were going to get to that. So I didn't hear the Donald Trump part.
Well, look, the question is, where does it all end? You know, from
2020? Sorry.
One would hope so, yes. Look, I think, you know, when you look at this whole narrative of trade war, yeah, from day one, my view is that the Chinese were keen to buy the problem out. Mm. If the U.S. said, impose voluntary restraint on these exports, open up these imports for further importing to China, and let's target deficit reduction of $100 billion, I think the Chinese would have been very, very happy to say yes, yes, yes to all of those. Mm-hmm. And played ball. What has happened from the Chinese perspective is the narrative keeps shifting. It's not just about trade. It's about intellectual property. It's not about intellectual property. It's about China's geopolitics. It's about the way governance works in China. It's about the way China intervenes in industrial policy. All of the above. And all of a sudden, it's gone from a fairly narrow issue of, you know, this notion of very large trade deficit between the two countries and what can be done to remediate that, to something much bigger, much more all-encompassing.
Okay.
This has made the end very nebulous. It's not clear, short of becoming American, the Chinese can satisfy the Americans.
Okay, well, we have focused a lot on the baggage that we're taking into 2019, so to speak. But your report does have some positives or potential positives for Asia in 2019. We'll just try and go through as many as possible. One of them being low oil prices that could keep inflation down. I'd like to ask, what's your view on oil prices, especially in view of Qatar leaving OPEC that was announced yesterday?
Right. Well, first of all, Elliot, it cuts both ways.
Okay.
It's not good news for Malaysia. It's also not good news for some of the commodity producers in Indonesia, although Indonesia now has become a big oil importer, so from that perspective, it helps.
Yes.
For exporters, it's not good news, but as far as Asia is concerned, most countries are importers, so yes, low oil will keep a lid on inflation. It will reduce the funding crunch that many countries were facing this year to some extent. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it's good news. But a lot of times, large capital expenditure tends to be commodity related, you know, big oil field, big gas field. Okay. Those things, of course, will be less likely to materialize if we have oil at 50s. But as you just pointed out, it's been pretty volatile. In the last 24 hours, you know, we have seen oil go in the other direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, low oil or stable oil would be helpful, but there are lots of risks around that. Most important of all is what happens between the U.S. and Iran through the course of 2019.
Right. We want to touch on more of the potential positives for Asia, according to your report, Taymor, and we'll get Ryan to join in a short while. But my question for you now, we saw a sharp market sell-off in October. What do you take away from that, Taymor?
It was inevitable, particularly with respect to the U.S. stock market. My view, the best gauge of looking at valuation metrics, not from a very short-term trading perspective, but from a long-term signals perspective, is the Case-Shiller cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio, which Robert Shiller sort of introduced and has been, you know, one of the key indicators for people to look at where the valuation stands.
Mm.
And there, it stands exceptionally high, even after the recent correction in the U.S. So the market, when it sees such high valuation, will constantly look for validation. Is the latest earning report good enough to justify such high valuation? Is the Fed hike going to spoil that valuation story? And the moment by October, it was clear that the Fed was keen to continue hiking. That was straw number one. High oil prices, straw number two. And the fact that investment sentiments were getting hurt by this U.S.-China tension was straw number three. It all came together, and we saw a fairly brutal sell-off. I would have expected this year the fixed income market to sell off even further, given that U.S. labor market was tightening, wages were picking up, and the Fed was hiking. We haven't actually seen that much of a sell-off yet. And also in the credit space, which is corporate bonds, there's been some distress. But my fear is that if rates keep going up, much more action in those areas await us in 2019.
Okay. We're speaking with Taymor Begg from DBS Group Research.
Hey, Taymor. So we've seen all these rising trade tensions, and there is a story about China being affected. So what is your take on how the ASEAN region will benefit, especially Singapore, looking at some of the PMI numbers that came out last night? The electronics sector doesn't seem to be doing very well for Singapore right now.
We felt that it was just a matter of time before the weakening PMI. By the way, this is not the first bad PMI number. I mean, through the course of the last 6 months.
First one under 50, though.
That's correct. So now it's scary bad, yes. But it's been weakening, and not just in Singapore, but all across the electronic supply chain of Asia, we've seen a weakening of PMI. So if you see one of the charts in our annual outlook, we show that PMI on a GDP-weighted basis, average PMI for the region, has been slipping since June, July. Exports haven't slipped yet. Normally, they tend to follow each other, but they haven't slipped. Maybe some degree of front-loading of exports ahead of some of the tariffs. So we might actually see actual bad trade numbers materialize in the coming months to follow that historical relationship between PMIs and electronics exports. But going back to Yasmin's question about the positives, herein lies one potential positive, which is we are hearing from investors a lot of questions about, is there value returning to Asia? We've had a fairly sharp sell-off in equity markets. And unlike the Case-Shiller measure that I told you about, the U.S., which still is flashing exceptionally high valuation, Asia doesn't seem that highly valued. So there might be some opportunities there.
Okay, Temo, just get your thoughts on how investors should be approaching 2019. You've been talking about U.S. growth hitting its peak. So does this mean U.S. dollar also at peak? Is this going to get any better from here?
Very popular question these days, both internally and externally of DBS. So here is the nuanced view, which is that peak growth does not necessarily mean peak dollar. Because even if U.S. growth were to slow next year to say 2.5%, it's a very, very good number. 2-3 years ago, if you told somebody in the Fed or the White House or anywhere else in the academic community that so late in the cycle, the U.S. is still likely to register 2.5% growth, they would have taken it very, very happily. So from the Fed's perspective, if growth next year is 2.5, which feels slower than this year, but still a very good number, unemployment in the mid-threes, around 3.5, 3.6, wage growth around 3%, and core inflation still hovering around 2%, the Fed will be compelled to keep hiking rates, in our view, and that would keep the dollar strong, even though growth has peaked.
We're having a 2019 economic outlook with the help of Temo Beg, Chief Economist, DBS Group Research. Temo, since we are talking about 2019, one of the things that has been highlighted is there are going to be a lot of elections next year. We're talking India parliamentary elections, Indonesia presidential elections. Let's get your thoughts on how do elections typically affect markets and the economy. I know it's got something to do with a little bit of uncertainty before a new leader is announced.
Right. Indonesia now has had a number of elections every 5 years in an orderly manner, and we have seen very popular people leaving office, new people coming in, and it has really not had that much of an impact on the economy or the markets.
Okay.
You have some relief rally around the elections a little bit here and there, but sustainably, you cannot trade that. So when we saw that, we said, let's ask this question in the context of India. India is a very noisy, vivacious democracy. The press talks about election risks a year and a half before the election actually takes place. Do the markets respond to that? And the takeaway from India is that it's not that different from Indonesia. Okay. There's a lot of noise around elections, but economic policy doesn't really change. Consider the last election in India. Narendra Modi's election was a seismic shift in the balance of power in India with BJP taking over from Congress. But as far as a policy direction was concerned, financial inclusion, goods and services tax reform, fiscal consolidation, nothing really changed. In fact, some of the weak things that Congress was doing remained in place. Some of the strong things Congress was doing was perhaps strengthened. Okay. So policy continuity remained. And if you were sort of trading India, it really wouldn't have paid that much to be super bullish or bearish. It just followed the economic fundamentals pretty well. So our view is, unlike in Europe, where in the past there used to be a very clear political business economic cycle. People suppress inflation before elections, let the Gini go out after the elections.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen like that in Asia. Maybe the governments are not that powerful here.
And, you know, here in Singapore, we are set to have a cabinet reshuffle take place after budget 2019. How do our markets react to news like this?
I think that logic can be extended in the context of Singapore even further, that the consensus with regard to long-term policymaking, what is happening to, say, CPF policy or retirement age or what's happening with the country's reserves, these questions I don't think ever will be determined by an election outcome. These are deeper, longer-run questions with far-reaching implications. And I think that the core of the political leadership in Singapore fully own these trajectories of reform. Okay. So I really don't think the cabinet reshuffle or the 2020, 2021 elections, whenever they may come, would lead to a material change in economic policy direction.
Okay, interesting point of view. Also, as we go into 2019, Temo, personally, your New Year resolution, do you have any to share with us?
It's a shallow one.
I
recently completed a 10K race,
nice.
So now I'm to go further, maybe like a 20K next year. So that's
You're doubling it.
Yeah.
You're not just adding 5K.
So I went from 5 to 10. So I think that, you know, the next one should be 10 to 20.
No, add one more, make it a half marathon. You can do it.
21?
Yeah,
I suppose I could.
Well, thank you so much for coming by the studio this morning. Tamer Beg, Chief Economist and MD at DBS Group Research.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.